My guest today, Patrick Coburn, was one of the more important correspondents covering the war in Iraq, about which we interviewed him at the time, and he has written several books on the country's history, including Saddam Hussein and American Obsession, co-authored with Brother Andrew, written before the war, The Occupation, War and Resistance in Iraq, and Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival and the Struggle for Iraq. He won the Marta Gellhorn Prize in 2005, the James Cameron Prize in 2006, and the Orwell Prize for Journalism in 2009. He is also the brother of my late friend and the outstanding journalist in his own right, Alexander Coburn, whose weekly column graced the pages of the Anderson Valley Advertiser for many years, right up to his death in July. I contacted Patrick for another interview after learning that he just spent 10 days in Syria and reading his reports of his trip to the London Independent. Welcome, Patrick Coburn, again to Takes on the World.
Thank you.
The last time we spoke in June was a little more than a month before Alexander's passing, and those of us who knew him and admired him have not quite got over it, being reminded every Wednesday, like today, when his column no longer appears in the pages of the Anderson Valley Advertiser. Perhaps you might want to say a few words about Alexander from your own perspective as his brother and part of an incredible journalistic family.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I miss him enormously. He'd been ill for about 2 years. He wanted to keep it a secret because he didn't want to be treated as an invalid, but I was talking to him every couple of days by Skype. And up to the end, he retained a sort of gaiety, a determination. He went on writing columns. He never sort of surrendered to the illness until the very last. I still have an intense sense of loss whenever I think of him.
Well, it's shared by many of people who knew him, and it was a well kept secret, especially in a day to day, like everything is known very quickly even before it happens. Well, you've just spent 10 days in Syria, with that bloody war between the Syrian government and those trying to take it down, seeing no prospect of ending. But what you've written about it in the Independence is leaving Damascus presents a kind of a different picture about the status of the conflict than what we read and hear in the U.S. media. Perhaps you can go into that a bit.
Yes, I mean, I find, when I got to Damascus, it is really very different from the picture you get in the from the foreign media or even, talking to people in Beirut. I mean, you get the sort of feeling there that the Assad government is on its last legs. It's about to collapse. The rebels are closing in on central Damascus. And when you get there, I mean, yeah, there is a lot of fighting, but the government controls most of the main cities. I mean, it controls all the main cities effectively. I drove from Damascus about 100 miles north to Homs, which is the third biggest city in Syria and used to be the center of the revolution. And there were a few shots fired, but really not many. When I got to Homs, there was no shooting at all. So I think that this idea that the Syrian government is about to collapse is really wishful thinking and certainly exaggerated.
Well, there's been, of course, from the very beginning, particularly from elements of the Israel lobby, like the Washington Souvenirs policy, to get the U.S. to intervene more than it has, and the degree that it has is difficult to know in terms besides logistics, things like that. But there seems to be a kind of reluctance on the part of NATO to actually intervene in the extent that it even it did in Libya, even given the Russian threat of Russia has nothing to do with NATO, of course, but the nature of the resistance or the opposition of the government has taken such international form, particularly with this al-Nusra front, so-called jihadist, that there seems to be trepidation about what's going to happen if and when Assad falls.
Yeah, I think that's very much the case. Up to the moment, there was in Washington, London, Paris, elsewhere, There were predictions that the government was going to fall. 130 countries have recognized the national coalition, which is the main opposition, as the legitimate representative of Syria. But I mean, very bizarrely, in fact, really it is amazing that at the very same moment that the U.S. was recognizing this coalition as the representative of Syria, they condemned its main military arm, the al-Nusra Front, as being a terrorist organization linked to al-Qaeda. So, you know, it's not surprising that, you know, quite a number of Syrians say, hold on a minute, you know, you just recognize these guys as our legitimate government, but you also say that their military wing are a collection of terrorists. You know, there's some contradiction here.
Well, is this an al-Nusra Front? Are they Syrians, or are they a mixture of men from Middle East countries who experienced fighters like those, the Sunnis who were fighting the U.S. and Iraq? Is this a Syrian-based organization, or is it like an international force?
It's Syrian-based, but its most effective fighters seem to come from Iraq, or Syrians who've been in Iraq. Well, that's why it's more effective. It's also better disciplined, and it also has more sort of financial resources from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, so it can afford to buy more equipment and pay its men more.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the Gulf, because Qatar, the owner of Al Jazeera, beginning with the Libyan situation, kind of decided to kind of put its heavy hand into the reporting, and then became very pro rebels in Libya. We're describing them as the Democrats are on the march, so to speak.
Sure. Again, it's another bizarre aspect of this, that this supposedly democratic revolution, it certainly started off that way in Syria, you know, a genuine uprising of the people against the regime. But suddenly the main backers are one of the few absolute monarchies left on earth, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, places where there is absolutely no democracy, where there's no freedom of expression. So, it's full of, this is a revolution and an uprising full of contradictory elements. So, well, I mean, in some ways a genuine revolution, but in other ways, it's a sectarian attack.
Is there a sense, if you got in Damascus, that the peaceful uprising or peaceful protest, in which this is the way it began in Syria, might have had a chance if it didn't quickly turn into an insurrection?
It might. On the other hand, the government reacted, very violently towards it. It did want it to be, people who demonstrated were shot, people they were tortured, etc. There was a genuine element in this. But these days, when I was in Damascus, one thing that everybody was talking about was that on YouTube, there were there was a very grisly scene of two government officers being beheaded, one of them by a 9-year-old, 10-year-old boy. And not surprisingly, this really frightens people who were might be deemed to be on the government side.
Well, this also is a situation in which the non-Sunnis in Syria, the various Alawites and Christian, various religious sects who were more or less protected or privileged before the uprising began, are very concerned, seem very concerned about what might happen should the rebels win.
Yeah, the rebels, are 70% of the population is Sunni, Muslim. If they win, what's going to happen to the other 30%? There's also, another aspect of this, which is this was very much a sort of movement originally of the villages and the rural poor against the cities. A place like Aleppo, when the rebels come in, they looted everything, government offices, schools, shops. It's sort of a sense of almost revenge by people coming from the villages. It reminded me a lot of Baghdad in 2003, when Semele the Poor from Sada City poured into the center and really stripped it like locusts. So, not surprisingly, people in Aleppo, you know, now wonder, they may not like the government, Malvasad, much, but they wonder if the alternative is going to be even worse.
Well, from what I gather, and not being there, although I saw Lebanon before the civil war and at the end of it, that the rebel that came from out of town into Aleppo attacked government positions, knowing that the government would then retaliate against the people of Aleppo. And it was like no government, whatever its base is going to tolerate an insurrection, whether it's a so-called democracy or a dictatorship, except, of course, the Syrian experiences, there was no gray zones. For Syrian government's history is not one of being able to handle peaceful demonstrations. But is there a sense that you got that in Damascus that the rebels have kind of used or abused the situation in order to bring the retaliation and essentially destroy some of the oldest, marvelous cities of the world?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of forms of destruction. When the rebels came into Aleppo, it appears, I mean, everybody seems to say this, including the rebels, because the rebels who set fire to the souks, you know, these ancient souks.
Markets, yes.
Markets have been there for, you know, 600-700 years. In other areas, they've taken the government sort of launches a sporadic artillery fire and some aerial bombing, so people flee, so they become sort of ghost towns. And you see that around Damascus, and you see that in Aleppo. Now, you know, this doesn't excuse what the government is doing, but often, you know, people in these areas plead with the rebels not to come in, but they say, look, you know, we're the ones who's going to bear the brunt of this, and you can't defend us or anything like that. But the rebels seems to be their tactic to come in. And then you have a stalemate, you have a standoff. The government, the rebels aren't strong enough to take Damascus or the other cities, but the government isn't strong enough to push them out. So you have these divisions in all these cities. It reminds me of sort of Beirut during the Civil War.
Well, of course, there, as far as I recall, these were purely Lebanese factions, and the international repercussions, although there were fears upon the United States had some concerns, but in terms of the international implications of the outcome of that civil war in Lebanon were nothing like what we see in Syria, where Syria seems to be right in the center of so many situations that whatever happens there is going to have an impact on every other country in the neighborhood.
Yeah, and those countries know it, so they... You know, they fund different groups. They have their proxies, you know. They'll get support from Turkey, or they'll get support from Saudi Arabia, or somebody in Kuwait, or something like that. And when you have just so many cooks involved in this, you know, it gets very difficult to stop, because they all have their motivations. They all begin to have their paymasters outside the country. And in the meantime, the country's been sort of torn apart. You know, it's full of internal refugees, people who've, you know, have moved out of that neighborhood, but it's being shelled, they've moved into schools or something nearby. You have people who have been very frightened, there are death squads wandering about, you know, but both government and rebel. So you increasingly you have a society which is sort of very deeply divided and reminds me more and more of Iraq.
Do the people you spoke with in Damascus and when you in there in Syria, do they see this as part of a regional, apart from what the United States or Britain or France think, or even Israel, as part of a Sunni Shia war that was exacerbated by the Shia taking over of a century-old Sunni domination of Mesopotamia or Iraq?
They see it that way, but it, you know, it's a combination of different conflicts, each making the other worse. There's a sense, you know, there's originally a genuine revolution of the people against the regime. You have also the sort of the poor against the rich, you know, the people who didn't benefit from the Assad government out in the villages. And you also have just pure sectarianism, which is getting worse and worse, with the Alawites who sort of dominate the government. They're a kind of Shia feeling, you know, they've got nowhere to run to, so they might as well fight to the finish. Sunni thinking more and more along sectarian lines, thinking, you know, why do we need these minorities?
So this, is there any sense with the various, you know, threats recently? There was an article in the papers here about how the Israelis, using satellites, had detected the Syrian military mixing what they claimed to be sarin gas, mixing chemical weapons to be used in 500-pound bombs, and that the U.S., Russia, whatever, gave a leaned on the, or warned the Syrian government not to do that, and supposedly they had pulled back on that. Is there much concern, discussion about the possibility of chemical weapons, or is that...
Not a lot. It's more sort of outside the country than in. You know, sometimes when I hear all this about chemical weapons, you'd think that conventional bombs and shells, you know, were harmless. You know? You don't actually have to use these poison gas. You want to kill a lot of people. You just, you know, you use conventional weapons, you know, just as will kill people just as surely as sarin gas. I don't really know what to make of that story. It was obviously being hyped abroad. You know, did it have substance? Was the government trying to keep poison gas away from the rebels? Were they sort of maybe saying to people, we'll fight to the finish, we'll do anything? I don't know. But it had a sort of strong whiff of propaganda about it, you know, and obviously reminded lots of people all over the world of what was said in 2003 about Saddam's non-existent weapons of mass destruction.
Well, then the excuse of the neocons was that Saddam had shipped all his chemical weapons to Syria. I remember.
Yeah, you know, it's not that difficult to make some of these things. You know, it's sort of something that hits a button. But I think it's exploited for some propaganda reasons.
How do you see Russia's position in this?
Actually, I think, you know, Russian position is actually much more sensible. It gets credit for. You know, they're saying, look, this... needs to be ended by negotiation, that you can't have... The rebels are saying, well, a precondition is that Assad should go. But hold on a minute. Assad controls the largest armed force in the country by far. He controls most of the cities and most of the population. So why should he go before negotiations? Why should he agree to leave? You know, a lot of the reporting gives the impression he's clinging on by his fingertips, but he obviously isn't. In the very long term, maybe his chances aren't so great. But for the moment, you know, if we're talking about what happens in 2013, you know, there's good reason to think he'll be there at the end of it. And I'm sure he thinks that.
Well, one of the problems seems to be that both sides, the so-called national coalition, which is actually forced together, I mean forced to come together by its supporters from the outside, and the Assad government have both preconditions that kind of prohibit any kind of dialogue.
That's right, and the longer this goes on, you know, you get what Northern Ireland we used to call the politics of the last atrocity, you know. But there are so many atrocities that nobody wants to really talk to each other. You know, they've just been subjected to massacre. You know, so you, there's this kind of, you know, you think, could this balance of power change? You know, what would change it? Well, obviously it'd be changed if you had NATO coming in, like Libya, and, you know, becoming the air force of the rebels, but that doesn't look very likely. The rebels are making some advances, but not that significant for the moment. And the government, there haven't been really any defections from the core of the regime. So it looks pretty stable at a very high level of bloodshed at the moment.
Well, actually, given some of the atrocities committed by the rebels, defectors would be taking their life in their hands. I mean, even if they pretended or they decided that they wanted to oppose the regime. The interjection of the Patriot missiles in Turkey to defend against the likelihood of a Syrian air attack, it seems kind of remote and ridiculous.
Yeah, I think it's pretty sort of, I mean, it's symbolic or silly, I think, because the Turks have a very big, the biggest army in the region, I think. And so it's very unlikely the Syrians are going to attack them, particularly in their present condition. So it's,
you know, that's, I suppose that is a symbol of support or an attempt to give the impression that Syria is, you know, a mighty power which is about to invade its neighbors, which it obviously isn't.
What do they think of in terms of the likelihood of Israel doing anything? Israel's now beefing up its military positions on the Golan. But how do they see, if any, Israel's involvement in this? Or is this totally...
I don't really know. I mean, you know, there may be some political involvement. I'm not sure. It isn't necessarily, they say, that, you know, they'll be glad when Assad goes, but if there's a takeover by the Muslim Brotherhood, they set their hostilities to Israel as, if anything, greater than that of Assad. So I don't think that that's going to change things much.
Oh, I was thinking,
I think that there is a genuine fear, you know, actually not just in Israel, but in Washington, London, and so forth, that somehow they're backing the rebels. They've recognized them as the legitimate government of Syria. But at the same time, you know, it's evident that the cutting edge of the rebels, you know, their military force, is very close to al-Qaeda, you know. And if it takes over Syria, you will have a sort of... And that will also destabilize Iraq. So I think they're very sort of nervous about what's happening. They're less sort of enthusiastic about getting rid of Assad. Less enthusiastic than they were a year ago.
Now, you went to Damascus from Beirut.
Yeah, I drove through it. It's difficult to get visas to go to Damascus. I did get a visa. One of the problems is that most of the sort of international media is not on the in Damascus, and their sources tend to be rebel sources and so forth. So I don't think, you know, I think the picture you get in most of the newspapers and on television is really pretty skewed. It's pretty suspect. You drive through the mountains, and it wasn't, I think I counted 8 checkpoints between the border and Damascus. Which isn't a very very long road. It used to take about 2 hours, 2.5 hours to get from Beirut to Damascus. I think it took me 5 hours. Damascus itself, people with big traffic jams, you can hear sort of shelling in the distance. They sort of echo, sound echoes off the mountains near the city. Big traffic jams, lots of checkpoints, people worried, but life sort of going on still.
It doesn't seem like a city under siege from your perspective.
It's not under siege. You know, it's under pressure, but not under siege. You know, you can go south to the Jordanian border. You can go to Beirut. You can go north. There are other roads that were blocked. You know, it's sort of other things when I was there. You know, I was sort of see on television battles rage on the airport road. You know, there were some snipers on the airport road. You know, pretty good reason for not going down that road. But the actual airport itself, at that moment, you know, didn't have a pane of glass broken. So because the media isn't there, you get a sort of exaggerated impression of the severity of the fighting in areas like that.
You had a funny line in even though this is not a funny situation, your article in the Independent of December 30th, where you, with the reliance on the rebels for the stories, you say the willingness of the international media, based often in Beirut but also in London and New York, to regurgitate with so little skepticism was essentially good quality propaganda. It's as if prior to the U.S. presidential election in November, foreign journalists had been unable to obtain visas to enter the U.S. and had instead decided to rely on Republican Party militants for their information on the campaign. Moreover, Republican activists based in Mexico and Canada. I thought that was a great line, a great paragraph.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's all too true, I'm afraid.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of ludicrous. You know, there is a good reason why courts don't like hearsay evidence. You know, they kind of want witnesses to have seen things with their own eyes. Otherwise, they don't want to hear what they say. And it's pretty amazing that journalists and so well-known publications repeat third-hand information of things they haven't seen themselves and actually might have very little knowledge of, and coming from biased sources. And I don't know, it's always, it somehow seems to me the reporting of Syria is actually worse than that of Iraq, the Iraq War, or the Afghanistan War. Hmm. I'm not quite sure why it is, but standards have got a lot lower than they used to be.
My guest is Patrick Coburn. We're speaking about Syria. If you have any questions or comments, the number here, of course, is 895-2448, 895-2448. What about the stability of Lebanon? Is that at all in jeopardy by the uprising?
To a degree, it is. On the other hand, Lebanese have been through so much. There's kind of a balance of power between the different sects. You know, the Hezbollah, the Shia, you know, very reliant on Syria. So but I'm not sure it's, you know, there's fighting in Tripoli in the north between Alawites and Sunni sniping, you know, people being killed. That's a bit ominous. But on the other hand, hopefully Lebanese have suffered so much that they'll hesitate quite a lot before they go down that road again.
We do have a caller. Let's see. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to ask Patrick a question about whether he can take seriously Hillary Clinton's desire for a rebel coalition that does not include al-Nusra, and how in the world would she be able to convince the Qataris and the Saudis to stop supporting these people?
Yeah, I mean, good question. I mean, the answer is she can't, you know. I mean, it's kind of the U.S. and its allies kind of want to have their cake and eat it. They want to support the the rebels, but are sort of but somehow not their main military wing. So you know, this is kind of fantasy land, really.
Well, that was Hillary, of course, has ideas for the 2016 election. Hopefully, the Syrian civil war. It seems even something beyond a civil war, something kind of unprecedented with the presence of outsiders. But the damage being done to Syria because the weapons being used are so much more powerful than those that were used among the factions in Lebanon. If that war in Syria would go on as long as the Lebanese civil war went on, there'd be nothing left.
Yeah, it is already. It's done enormous damage, you know, and it also, the hatreds created, you know, and not just not going to go away. You know, there's material damage. You know, Aleppo was a great sort of commercial center for Syria. Now, you know, many of the factories are burnt out. The owners and the managers and a lot of the workers have fled. You know, it's going to take time to recover from that. But also, you know, when you have any civil war, it creates hatreds, but this sort of, when you have massacres, big and small, you know, people don't really forgive. People don't, it's also very difficult for people to live beside each other. You know, we've got a very horrible and recent example of that in Iraq.
It's interesting that it's not well publicized here, but the Iraqi government, al-Maliki, is at least quietly and cooperating and supporting the Syrian government. And the U.S., I know, has protested Iran overflights to Damascus, but they have not done that very loudly because it would simply show the U.S. Failed in Iraq to do what it probably intended to do.
Yeah, and this is, you know, you talk to Iraqis, you know, Shia Iraqis and so forth, you know, they're all very nervous. They sort of think, you know, if Syria gets taken over by the Sunni, we'll be next. It will reignite the civil war in Iraq. Not sure how true that might be, but, you know, there's a good chance they're right. So they've got a lot to be frightened of.
I also want to bring up the Kurdish situation because the Turkey has been having a long-time war with its own Kurds. There's a Kurdistan, essentially, in northern Iraq, and we have Kurds, Assyrian Kurds, were kind of caught in between in this situation. I think there's been some divisions, but how do people see the Kurdish situation working out? Any major...
Yeah, it's an important question because you've got about 2.5 million Kurds, mostly in the north along the Kurdish border. they basically taken over their area and are now sort of semi-independent, de facto independent. A bit like what happened to the Iraqi Kurds after the war in 1991. And the longer the present conflict goes on, the more the Syrian Kurds will sort of create their own sort of autonomous state linked to the Kurds elsewhere. So this is, you know, one sign of Syria fragmenting. You know, it isn't, it's another source of sort of tension and stress within the country.
There was some talk early on of Assad taking the government or removing himself and his leadership and family and so on and to an Alawite conclave. Is that being discussed at all? Or was it,
it's being discussed. I just don't quite buy that.
You
know, one, they don't have to do that. They're a long way from that. You know, they still control Damascus. Why should they set off there? Secondly, you know, these guys have been in power in Damascus for a long time. You know, they're not going to, they're not going to return to their mountains. One, they wouldn't be safe there. And secondly, you know, what could they do there? So I think that, you know, they're more likely, if, you know, they're ultimately defeated, to flee to, you know, to anywhere, whether it's Iraq or to Iran or maybe, you know, maybe to Paris or London. But, you know, they're quite a long way off that. But this idea of sort of a little, the Alawi, or, you know, about 2.5-3 million in Syria, somehow having a lot sort of last stand in the mountains, I don't really buy this. These guys have come from the mountains a long time ago. They're not going to return there.
I haven't seen so much in the papers lately of Shabia, the so-called paramilitaries, pro-government paramilitaries who are accused of certain atrocities. What's happened with them?
I think they're around. Yeah, I mean, you know, the Alawite militia or pro-government militia, you know, or acting as death squads and so forth. That sort of, you know, they're a big ingredient poisoning the atmosphere, and they commit atrocities, you know, and there are counter-atrocities, and then they counter them, and so forth. That's the sort of atmosphere you have, and it's getting worse.
And meanwhile, the non-combatants either flee across the border or find it almost impossible or harder to survive. It seems that the headlines in the papers today about the problem of the aid agencies trying to take care of people in need.
Yeah, I mean, the weather's getting worse. It's getting cold. The Turks don't want to receive that number of people. The big riots in a refugee camp with 50,000 people in it in Jordan. What are these people going to do? All that situation is boiling up. And again, there's no reason it should get any better.
Well, finally, you were pessimistic in the conclusion of your article, but how would you sum up for our listeners what you see the prospects are for Syria's future?
I think that, you know, the prospects are for war and more war. I can't see the government going down, imploding like in Libya, without something very dramatic outside the country happening. The only thing could end it would be negotiations, but you can't have a precondition that Assad should go because he says he's too powerful. The rebels, you know, would basically, what they wanted at the beginning was a sort of Libyan solution that they got massive backing from abroad, then they were going to win. I don't think they still think they might win a military victory. It's only when both sides realize they're not going to win a military victory that you will actually have serious negotiations and maybe the conflict could be brought to an end. But there isn't really much sign of that yet.
Well, Patrick Coburn, thank you so much for bringing us up to date on Syria, and may you have another very productive new year. And again, we look forward to speaking with you again on Takes on the World. Thanks for being our guest today.
Thank you so much.
Take care.